Prologue. What would you do? Suppose you stumbled upon the constitution of an organization that was terrorizing the world. Would you ignore such a document, or would you read it? Suppose you discovered that this constitution's most prominent themes were pain and punishment, thievery and violence, intolerance and war. If the regime's charter ordered its devotees to kill, plunder, and terrorize, would you sound the alarm? What if this constitution was supported by a manifesto that contained the only authorized biography of the regime's founder, and the first devotees of this doctrine, its co-founders, said that their leader was a sexual predator, a pirate, and a terrorist? If you found such evidence, what would you do with it? What if this leader motivated his mercenaries to murder and mayhem by allowing them to keep what they had stolen in the name of the cause, their victims' homes, businesses, money, and even their women and children? All right, no more hypotheticals. I'm going to share some passages from this Constitution, from the covenant of the world's largest and most violent organization. I've changed the names to disguise the source without altering the message.
Your leader has sent you from your homes to fight for the true cause. Your leader wished to confirm the truth by his words, "Wipe those who disagree with us out to the last. We shall terrorize everyone who isn't like us. So smite them on their necks and every joint and incapacitate them, for they are opposed to our doctrine and to our leader. Whosoever opposes our doctrine and our leader should know that we are severe in retribution. And know that one-fifth of what you acquire as booty in war is for our great leader. The rest is for you. The use of such spoils is lawful and good."
This popular and misunderstood constitution says,
"Fight them until all opposition ends and the only our doctrine rules. If you meet anyone who disagrees with us in battle, inflict on them such a defeat as would be a lesson for those who would come after them, that they may be warned. Slaughter those who disagree with us, wherever you find them. Lie in wait for them. They are specimens of foolishness. Punish them so that our superior dogma and leader can put them to shame. If you apprehend treachery from a people with whom we have a treaty, retaliate by breaking it off. Those who do not think like us should know that they cannot bypass our doctrine. Surely they cannot get away. Fight them until they pay a heavy tax in submission to us. How perverse are they? Our leader and his doctrine will damn them. For anyone who offends our leader or opposes our doctrine will receive a painful punishment. We will burn them alive. So prepare against them whatever arms and weaponry you can muster, that you may strike terror into the enemies of our cause."
This Constitution is genuine, and millions follow its message. Exposing it, understanding it, might actually save you from the wrath it inspires. The covenant goes on to say,
"Our leader urged all who agree with us to fight. If there are 20 among you with determination, you will vanquish 200. If there are 100, you will vanquish 1,000 of our enemy, for they are a people devoid of understanding. Our leader drove your enemy back in fury. He motivated our side in battle. He made their citizens flee from their homes, and he terrorized them, so that you killed some and made many captives. Our great leader made you inherit their lands, their homes, and wealth, and gave you a country you had not traversed before."
This sounds like a terrorist manifesto, a covenant for war and genocide. Does anything this immoral, this out of touch with human decency, actually exist? If it did, and if it were this blatant, you'd expect to see its followers amassing their weaponry. You'd expect to see them rise up and terrorize the world. Not only would they feel it was their duty to kill, You'd expect their fallen assassins to be immortalized, hailed as martyrs, and paraded down crowded streets, banners waving, tears flowing, guns blazing, with angry diatribes spewing from hate-filled faces. You'd expect them to wage war under the guise of doctrinal supremacy, wouldn't you? And if there were such people, our journalists and politicians would have ferreted them out, exposed them, and protected us, right? Wrong. With the exception of changing the names of the perpetrators and their victims, what we read is from the actual Constitution of an enormous, rapidly growing, extremely well-funded, and horrendously violent worldwide cult. And as bad as that sounds, it gets worse in context. The manifesto proudly proclaims that unarmed civilians were annihilated by armed gangs. Men were decapitated on the orders of the dogma's founder. Thousands of children were sold into slavery. Women were raped, the leader himself participating. Townships were plundered, businesses were looted, and productive assets were destroyed. The villains slept in their victims' beds, abusing their wives and daughters, and each bloody affair was meticulously recorded by the founder's companions and later chronicled by the regime's most esteemed clerics. It's time to turn the page. Let's look at what the founder's companions had to say about their leader and his manifesto. Once again, I will change the names, but nothing else.
Kill them. For he who kills them will get a great reward. Our leader said, our doctrine assigns for a person who participates in battles in our cause to be rewarded with booty if he survives, or he will be admitted into the hall of heroes if he is killed in battle as a martyr. Had I not found it difficult for my followers to do without me, I would have remained in army units, fighting great battles, and I would have loved to have been martyred for the cause.
The regime's founder is quoted in the doctrine's anti-Semitic manifesto, saying,
issue orders to kill every Jew in the country.
He was asked,
what is the best deed?
By one of his devotees, and the dictator replied,
to believe in me and our doctrine. What is the next best deed?
The devotee queried.
To fight on behalf of our cause,
he answered. At the end of one such conflict, one of the regime's lieutenants told his commander,
we have conquered another nation. The captives and the booty have been collected. Now, my leader, may I take a slave girl from among the prisoners? Take anyone you like,
the warlord replied, raping one himself. Ever mindful of his duty, the regime's leader proclaimed,
embrace our doctrine first, and then fight.
Followed by,
I have been made victorious with terror.
You have stumbled upon the constitution of the world's largest nation. And it's not China or Russia. You've just heard the words of its founding father, and he's not Lenin or Mao or Hitler. And today, this doctrine's adherents are doing what their founder and constitution ordered, fighting, ravaging civilians, stealing the world's possessions, and using them to terrorize. Since it's happening according to plan, shouldn't we muster the courage to expose it, to speak out against it? Or should we remain silent for fear of offending them? The answer is obvious, or is it? What if the names I substituted were Allah, Muhammad, and Islam? What if it's a religion? This constitution is the Quran, and the manifesto is the Islamic Hadith. The citizens of this nation are Muslims. They're doing what they were ordered to do. They left their homes to fight infidels. They stole our planes, ravaged our economy, slaughtered innocents in the name of Allah. They even confessed to the crime. Yet not a single national spokesperson or politician has had the courage to hold Islam accountable. Criticizing a religion is something that makes people squeamish, especially in the paranoid culture of political correctness. Christians say that we are to love, not judge. Jews, after millennia of persecution, are terrified of even the perception of intolerance. Secular humanists, in deference to multiculturalism and the peace process, have sacrificed truth on the altar of their political agenda. So why upset everyone? Why? Because they will continue to kill us if we don't expose them. But before revealing what the Quran and Hadith have to say about Muhammad and Islam, I'd like to clear up a few inevitable misconceptions. First, on Muslims. I love you in spite of your beliefs and your deeds. I would like nothing more than to free you from Islam. I agree with Renan, the famous scholar, who, after dedicating himself to understanding Islamic scripture, wrote, and I quote, "Muslims were the first victims of Islam. Many times I have observed in my travels that fanaticism comes from a small number of dangerous men who maintain others in the practice of this religion by terror. To liberate the Muslim from his religion is the best service that one can render to him." Unquote. Second, on Christians, we are responsible for the awful mess the world is in. We have turned a personal relationship with our Creator into an emasculated religion, confused and aimless. In the name of that religion, we have perpetrated inhumanities. Today, for fear of appearing hateful, we are apparently willing to let 1 billion people live in virtual slavery, perishing in ignorance and poverty. Tolerance of evil is not a Christian virtue. We are called to be discerning. Third, on Jews. I love you in spite of yourselves. 14 centuries ago, your forefathers sold Bible stories to Muhammad and then mocked him when he goofed them up. So by doing so, you manufactured your own enemy. Now you are a divided people, unsure of whether to appease or fight the terror you helped inspire. As the world's most lettered people, I fear you understand less than you know. I pray that you come to trust your God before it is too late. Fourth, on secular humanists, liberals, and agnostics, you are guilty of the very things you denounce in others. History is as condemning of man separating himself from God as it is of man-made religions establishing themselves as the intermediaries to God. The last 100 years have been especially indicting. Atheistic doctrines have annihilated more people than all religions combined. Truth is not relative, yet in today's media, secular humanists judiciously edit under the guise of enlightenment. While irritating, this practice is practically as lethal as it relates to Islam. The errant recasting of the religion as peaceful, the reshaping of jihad into a spiritual struggle, the impression you convey that Islam is tolerant and that the terrorists have corrupted their religion is wrong. Thousands have died in the wake of your illusions. Fifth, on Islam itself. Without deceit and sword, Islam would have been stillborn, an infinitesimal fraction of the 1 billion people subservient to Islam today actually chose their fate. In Mecca, 1,400 years ago, after a decade of preaching, as few as 50 men chose to follow Muhammad, but that all changed in Medina. There, according to the Quran and Hadith, Muhammad became a political tyrant, a terrorist, and a thief. His willingness to lead 75 armed raids against defenseless civilians swelled his ranks as swiftly as the spoils of war filled his pockets. Equipped with booty stolen from others, Muhammad and his followers conquered and then plundered their neighbors, starting with Arabia. The only choice they offered their victims was your money or your life. Once subjected to their will, Muslims compelled submission under penalty of death. Islam is and always has been a doctrine devoid of choice. It prospers as the business end of a bloody sword. Soon you will see why. The vast preponderance of today's Muslims do not know their prophet or their religion very well. Theirs is a life of ignorance, despair, tyranny, and mind-numbing ritual. They are kept in the dark, purposely deceived, for the benefit of cleric and king. There is no incentive for them to learn. Exposed to the truth, they would reject Islam, a decision that could cost them their lives. The Quran itself confirms this startling reality. In the fifth surah, the final revelation chronologically, Allah ordered Muslims, quote, not to question the Quran. For those who did, he said, would, quote, discard their religion, unquote. In that light, we should feel good about freeing Muslims from the oppressiveness of Islam. For by freeing them, we will free ourselves from the scourge of Islamic terror. Despite what you've heard in the media, there is but one Islam, a singular, correct view of Muhammad, Allah, and jihad. It is the one printed in the Quran and the Hadith. There is no independent record of Muhammad in history from which a variant view may be drawn. The Hadith and the Quran are the sole repository of information on this man, his times, means, and mission. The Muhammad of Islam, the God of Islam, and the religion of Islam must be as these sources present them. Lastly, Islam has no alibi, no reason to cry, unfair. The Quran condemns all non-Muslims, Christians and Jews, as well as those who worship many gods and no gods. It is an equal opportunity hater. Its attitude towards unbelieving infidels is overwhelmingly hostile. A cursory reading of the first 10 surahs is sufficient to prove that the relatively few nice verses were contradicted and replaced, abrogated in Muslim parlance, by a staggering number of nasty ones. In fact, the Quran was written to justify some of the most ungodly behavior the world has ever known. The simple truth is, good Muslims are bad people. Islam makes them that way. While there are plenty of bad Muslims who are good people, they are as impotent as bad Nazis in the Third Reich or bad communists during Stalin's era. The Quran defines good and bad Muslims for us. It says a good Muslim is a jihadist, a man who leaves his home, sacrificing his wealth and life, fighting in Allah's cause. Allah says they will be rewarded with stolen booty if they survive, or with a heavenly bordello if they die. Bad Muslims, on the other hand, are peaceful. Allah calls them hypocrites because they are unwilling to fight. He even says that peaceful Muslims are the, quote, most vile of creatures, unquote, and that hell's hottest fires await them. If you are a peace-loving Muslim, your God hates you. Good Muslims, those who read Islam's scriptures long before I cracked their covers, planned, funded, staffed, executed, and celebrated the terrorist attacks of 9/11. They proudly told the world what they were going to do, terrorize Americans and Jews into submission. They boldly proclaimed why they were going to do it, for the advancement of Islam. They even told us who they were, good Muslims. But we ignored their announcements. It was as if, on the morning of December 7, 1941, nobody noticed the rising sun insignias on the planes bombing Pearl Harbor. The bombers of September 11, 2001 wore insignias, too. Theirs was a crescent moon. For those who support the politically inspired notion that terrorism is not condoned by Islam, that terrorists have corrupted an otherwise peaceful religion, consider this. The world's foremost authority on the Quran is Sheikh Abdul Rahman. He is the senior professor of Quranic studies at Islam's most prestigious university, Al-Aqsar, in Cairo. Today, the Sheikh is a convicted terrorist, serving time in an American prison for the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. If the Quran espouses peace, that's hard to explain. The conflict between truth and perception doesn't end there. Rahman's disciples, an Egyptian sheikh and a Saudi terrorist, Osama bin Laden, told the film crew that Islam was their motivation for the second bombing. Quote, "Everybody praises the great action which you did, which first and foremost by the grace of Allah," unquote, the sheikh began. Quote, "This is the guidance of Allah and the blessed fruit of jihad. a beautiful fatwa. May Allah bless you. Unquote. Bin Laden agreed, quote, "We calculated in advance the number of casualties the enemy would suffer and who would be killed based on the position of the planes as they hit the towers. I was thinking that the fire from the gas in the planes would melt the iron structure of the buildings and collapse them. This is all that I had hoped for." The Sheikh replied, "Allah be praised." He shared how Muslims watching television exploded with joy, telling bin Laden, quote, "Egyptian TV ran a subtitle below the images of the crumbled buildings, 'In revenge for the children of Alaska, Osama bin Laden executes an operation against America,'" unquote. Bin Laden replied, "The brothers who conducted the operation knew they were on a martyrdom mission. Allah bless their souls." Al-Qaeda was actually accepting credit for a terrorist act it did not conceive. The plan was concocted, staffed, and financed in the Al-Qaeda Mosque in Hamburg, Germany. Today, the mosque's imam still preaches fundamental and uncorrupted Islam. He doesn't need to twist it, interpret it, or take it out of context. The imam's message is for all Muslims, and it is preached in every mosque. Listen as he reads the verse from the 8th surah, the one I disguised earlier. These words come directly out of the Quran's Spoils of War surah.
"Allah has sent you from your homes to fight for the true cause. Allah wished to confirm the truth by his words. Wipe the infidels out to the last. I will fill the hearts of the infidels with terror. So smite them on their necks in every joint and incapacitate them, for they are opposed to Allah and his apostle. Whoever opposes us should know that Allah is severe in retribution. The infidels will taste the torment of hell. So when you meet them in battle, do not retreat, for all who turn away from fighting will bring the wrath of Allah on themselves, and their abode will be hell. It was not you who killed them, but Allah who did so. You did not throw what you threw. Allah did so to bring out the best in the faithful."
Using this reasoning, it was the Islamic God, not Muslims, who flew the planes into the World Trade Center.
"So fight them until all opposition ends, and Islam is the only religion."
Now you know the truth. Allah wants infidels wiped out and terrorized. That makes war and terror mainstream Islam. And Allah was just getting warmed up.
"If you meet them in battle, inflict such a defeat as would be a lesson for those who would come after them, that they may be warned. Surely the infidels cannot get away. Prepare against them whatever arms and cavalry you can muster, that you may terrorize the enemies of Allah."
Reading Allah's orders out of the Quran's 8th surah, imams preach,
"O Prophet, urge the faithful to fight. If there are 20 among you with determination, they will vanquish 200. If there are 100, then they will kill 1,000 infidels, for they are a people devoid of understanding."
This is the math of terror. It is possible because infidels are ignorant of Islam. And you should know, the Quran defines infidels in the 5th surah.
"They are surely infidels who say Christ, the Messiah, is God."
So as not to be accused of unfairly singling out less than peaceful surah from the Quran, listen to how Allah recruits suicide bombers in the 4th surah.
"Those who barter their life in this world for the next fight in the way of Allah. Whether he is killed or victorious, a glorious reward awaits. Urge the believers to fight, to keep back the might of the infidels. Seize them and kill them, wherever they are. Muslims who sit idle are not equal to those who fight in Allah's cause, with their wealth and their lives. Allah has exalted those who fight for Islam."
The Islamic Sirah proclaims,
Ishaq says, "Our onslaught will not be a weak, faltering affair. We will fight as long as we live. We will fight until you turn to Islam, humbly seeking refuge. We will fight not caring whom we meet. We will fight whether we destroy ancient holdings or newly gotten gains. We have mutilated every opponent. We have driven them violently before us at the command of Allah in Islam. We will fight until our religion is established, and we will plunder them, for they must suffer disgrace.
Need more proof? Are the deeds of the most respected Quranic scholar, the words of the most illustrious Islamic terrorist, and the scripture readings of the most revered imams insufficient? After all, a senior Saudi sheikh said we shouldn't listen to bin Laden because he was an unlicensed cleric. Never mind that the popularity polls show bin Laden's approval rating at 75% among Muslims, much higher than any other cleric or leader. Then consider this quote from the Saudi ruling family's favorite imam, Al-Burayk. He's not only licensed, he's atop the pecking order. Prior to a telethon hosted to enrich the families of Palestinian suicide bombers, this esteemed cleric said, and I quote, "I am against America. She is the root of all evils and wickedness on earth. Muslims, don't take Jews and Christians as allies. Muslim brothers in Palestine, do not have any mercy or compassion on them, their blood, their money, or their flesh. Their women are yours to take legitimately. Allah made them yours. Why don't you enslave their women? Why don't you wage jihad? Why don't you pillage them?" Do you suppose the licensed Saudi cleric was corrupting Islam too? Sorry, it's Allah who commands Muslims not to befriend Christians and Jews, for he wants them killed so he can use their bodies to stoke hell's fires.
Quran 5:51. O believers, do not hold Jews and Christians as your allies. They are allies of one another, and anyone who makes them his friend becomes one of them. Quran 2:10. As for those who deny Islam, they will be faggots for the fires of hell.
Islam's God is a spirit of an entirely different color.
Ibn Ishaq in the Sirah. Allah said, "A prophet must slaughter before collecting captives. A slaughtered enemy is driven from the land. Muhammad, you crave the desires of this world, its goods and the ransom slaves would bring. But Allah desires killing them to manifest the religion."
The Saudi imam has correctly interpreted Islam's message.
From Bukhari. The prophet had their men killed, their children and women taken captive. Quran 33:26. Allah made the Jews leave their homes by terrorizing them, so that you killed some and made many captive. And he made you inherit their lands, their homes, and their wealth. And he gave you a country that you had not traversed before.
The Islamic warlords who rule Saudi Arabia were enthroned by the British by way of reward. The Brits bribed them to fight against their Muslim brethren, the Ottoman Turks, in World War I. Today, the Saudi dictators thank the West by manufacturing the terrorists who kill us. It's hardly a coincidence that 80% of the 9/11 suicide bombers were trained in the kingdom that gave birth to Islam. Yet the Fahd princes meet with our president and protest incessantly to our media, professing that they and their religion are peace-loving. They are incensed when people blame them for the terror that they have inspired. Forget for a moment that Muslim militancy is funded by the black ooze that flows from their sand. It's what they teach that is so devastating. 80% of the mosques in America and the West were built and are staffed by the Fahd warlords. They also provide their terrorist manufacturing facilities with their reading material. Their official Quran for the English-speaking market bears the stamp of the Fahd Foundation. In it, right below Surah 2, verse 190, the Quran's first mention of jihad, you'll find this passage.
Jihad is holy fighting in Allah's cause, with full force of numbers and weaponry. It is given the utmost importance in Islam, and is one of its pillars. By jihad, Islam is established. Allah's word is made superior, which means only Allah has the right to be worshipped. And Islam is propagated. By abandoning jihad, Islam is destroyed and Muslims fall into an inferior position. Their honor is lost, their lands are stolen, their rule and authority vanish. Jihad is an obligatory duty in Islam on every Muslim. He who tries to escape from this duty dies with one of the qualities of a hypocrite.
There is nothing peaceful about Islam. Muhammad's dogma breeds ruthless killers. At his direction, Muslims will continue to terrorize the world until there are no more non-Muslims. So that you might know what Islam does to men, I have organized 2,000 Islamic scriptures by topic in the Muhammad's Own Words appendix. Here are some excerpts from the Fighting Terror, War, and Jihad sections.
Ibn Ishaq. Allah and Muhammad humiliated every coward and made our religion victorious. We were glorified and destroyed them all. By what our apostle recites from the book, and by our swift horses, I liked the punishment the infidels received. Killing them was sweeter than drink. We galloped among them, panting for the spoil. With our loud-voiced army, the apostle's squadron advanced into the fray. From Tabati. Arabs were the first to respond to the call of the Prophet. We were Allah's helpers and the viziers of his messenger. We fight people until they believe in Allah. He who believes in Allah and his messenger has protected his life and possessions from us. As for the one who disobeys, we will fight him forever in the cause of Allah. Killing him is a small matter to us. From Muslim. The Prophet said at the conquest of Mecca, there is no migration now, but only jihad, fighting for the cause of Islam. When you are asked to set out on a jihad expedition, you should readily do so. Quran 61:4. Surely Allah loves those who fight in His cause. Ishaq, I am fighting in Allah's service. It is piety and a good deed. In Allah's war, I do not fear as others should, for fighting is righteous, good, and true. Bukhari, a man whose face was covered with an iron mask came to the Prophet and said, Allah's apostle, shall I fight or embrace Islam first? The Prophet said, embrace Islam first, and then fight. So he embraced Islam and was martyred. Allah's apostle said, a little work, but a great reward. Also from Bukhari, our Prophet, the messenger of our Lord, ordered us to fight you until you worship Allah alone or pay us the jizya tribute tax in submission. Our Prophet has informed us that our Lord says, whoever amongst us is killed as a martyr shall go to paradise to live such a luxurious life as has never been seen before, and whoever survives shall become your master. Quran 47:4. When you clash with the unbelieving infidels in battle, fighting jihad in Allah's cause, smite their necks until you overpower them, killing and wounding many of them. At length, when you have thoroughly subdued them, bind them firmly, making them captives. Thereafter, either generosity or ransom them based upon the benefits to Islam, until the war lays down its burdens. Thus you are commanded by Allah to continue carrying out jihad against the unbelieving infidels until they submit to Islam. Ishaq, it was so criminal. Men could hardly imagine it. Muhammad was ennobled because of the bloody fighting. I swear we shall never lack for soldiers nor army leaders. Driving before us infidels until we subdue them with a halter above their noses and a branding iron. We will drive them to the ends of the earth. We will pursue them on horse and on foot. We will never deviate from fighting in our cause. Any people that disobey Muhammad will pay for it. If you do not surrender to Islam, you will live to regret it. You will be shamed in hell, forced to wear a garment of molten pitch forever. Ishaq, when Allah gave permission to his apostle to fight, the second Aqaba contained conditions involving war, which were not in the first act of submission. Now we bound ourselves to wage war against all mankind for Allah and His Apostle. He promised us a reward in paradise for faithful service. We pledged ourselves to war in complete obedience to Muhammad, no matter how evil the circumstances.
Equipped with this information, you may form some important conclusions. Islamic politicos and clerics are purposely deceiving us. The truth isn't hidden, nor is it hard to find. Our media is clueless, willfully ignorant, and the cost is high. Good Muslims will continue to wage jihad until we stop them by eliminating their means and motivation. If we don't, they will kill us. As with the Nazis rolling into Poland following the peace process in the 1930s Europe, the perpetrators of Islamic terror are inflamed by a violent, racist doctrine. They too have an agenda, and we are ignorant of it. If we had responded then, as we do today, we'd be living on sushi and sauerkraut. In these pages, you will discover Islam's goals and read what it has to say about itself. You will see how violent conquest, racist genocide, and the spoils of war established the doctrine and turned a failed prophet into a world-renowned profiteer. I recognize that these words are incompatible with the prevailing wisdom of our politicians, religious leaders, and media. Yet the evidence is unambiguous and ubiquitous. The truth is undeniable. Islam rises and falls on Muhammad. He is the doctrine's sole prophet, its lone founder, its God's singular conduit. Yet Islam's most revered books reveal that he was unqualified. By putting the Quran in chronological order and by correlating it with the context of Muhammad's life as it was reported in the Sirah, the Sunnah, and the Hadith, we find that Allah mirrored his prophet's character. The Islamic scriptures demonstrate that Allah was too dumb to be a god and too immoral to be divine. While that may sound spiteful, it's true. Since the world is awash in immorality and foolishness, I will strive to make this discussion germane, pertinent to our place and time. I will accomplish this by connecting the dots between today's terrorist acts and fundamentalist Islamic doctrine. But rest assured, I will not critique Islam based on isolated verses pulled out of context. I will not expose it based upon the deeds of its followers. Within most doctrines, there are meritorious words and as many examples of good deeds as there are bad. Such an endeavor would reveal more about me than this subject. Instead, I shall focus this entire debate on what the Islamic scriptures have to say about the character and the deeds of the religion's founder, his God, and his companions, the original disciples in Christian parlance. But fear not, you won't be cheated. Islam condemns Islam sufficiently to persuade even the most ardent skeptic. If you're like most Americans, your defenses are raised the moment someone suggests that Islam might be responsible for Muslim militancy. You might think, as I once did, that all religions strike a balance between love and divine retribution, peace and punishment. But with Islam, that's simply not true. Their scriptures start out foolish, turn hateful, then punitive and violent. There is almost no mention of peace, tolerance, or love. We have been played for fools. And it was easy because only an infinitesimally small percentage of infidels have taken the time to learn about Islam. I wanted to know why Islamic terrorists thought killing us was good. Shouting Allahu Akbar, Allah is greatest, seemed like a confession, as did their parades. Muslims seemed ever ready to turn murderers into martyrs. Curious, I journeyed to the land of suicide bombers. There I asked a Mossad agent to arrange a meeting with members of 417, Arafat's secret service. This man, in turn, arranged for me to meet the actual terrorists, Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Alaska Martyrs Brigade, so that I could ask them directly, eyeball to gun barrel, why they killed. He did. I asked. And they told me. It's Islam. The terrorists said, we are following Muhammad's example, just obeying Allah's orders. In my presence, blood dripping from their hands, they recited their prophet's speeches. They confessed, no, bragged, about those they had just murdered for the good of their cause. Now, more curious than ever, I found copies of the five oldest Islamic books and spent 2 years studying Muhammad and his message. What I found was bone-chilling. The depiction of the prophet by the most revered Muslim sources is horrendous. Nearly every page reveals behavior that is immoral, criminal, and violent. I soon learned how fortunate we are that most Muslims don't follow in the footsteps of Muhammad, that they don't know their prophet, their religion, their scriptures, or their history very well. If they did and followed Islam, the whole world would be enveloped in war. Over 1 billion people are slaves to Islam. The word means submission. Their scriptures order them to obey the prophet, cleric, and king. And as a result, Muslims in Islamic nations live with no freedoms of thought, speech, press, or religion. Unemployment, poverty, and despair run rampant. Every aspect of a Muslim's life is controlled by Islamic despots, Islamic law, Islamic scripture, Islamic education, and Islamic culture. Women are treated more harshly and awarded fewer rights than Americans give their animals. Muhammad gave men the liberty to beat their wives. Everyone is indoctrinated with the same message of religious intolerance, racial hatred, and violence. They hear it from their dictators, from their media, from their teachers, and clerics. A collusion of influences has annihilated truth and shut out reason. With their words, Muslims tell Westerners that they and their religion are peace-loving. But this is because their holy books order them to deceive us. They are told to tell us peace until it's too late. America's president seems to have taken their bait, and the media doesn't seem to care. Yet Islamic history, both ancient and modern, shouts out an entirely different story. So which do you believe? If their words are true, why do you suppose they kill us? The answer is as clear as the skies over Pearl Harbor, as blatant as Blitzkrieg. What did the insignias on the planes and tanks tell us? People don't kill for fun. They don't attack without reason. They must be motivated to risk their lives for a cause. If the bombers are suicidal, death must be more profitable than living. Someone must inspire people to hate, train them, finance them, equip them, and help them plan their dastardly deeds. The culture, doctrine, and people that aid in the execution of terror must have something to gain from causing the deaths of others. And well, they do. Islam is all about power, control, and money. It has always been about power, control, and money. Terror isn't easy, nor is it cheap. The culture necessary to breed terrorists is extreme. It requires tight controls, total complicity, and years of unceasing indoctrination. If we wish to survive, we must come to understand Islam, a dogma capable of corrupting men to such a degree they believe mass murder is the ticket to paradise. Ignorance of this deception isn't tolerance. Acceptance isn't compassion. Appeasement will not lead to peace any more than accommodating the divine wind of the kamikaze suicide bombers would have advanced world harmony. All right, I've done a lot of talking. It's time I asked you a tough question. What do all the Islamic states that recruit, indoctrinate, finance, harbor, train, equip, motivate, and reward terrorists have in common? Too easy? Then I have another question. If the answer is so obvious, why is everybody afraid to say it? Our political leaders are sworn to defend us. The media's primary responsibility is to ferret out truth. The truth is obvious, accessible, and rationally irrefutable. So why? Why do we continue to fund our own funeral? Why do we frisk little old ladies at airports while we stand by and watch our enemies develop nuclear and biological capability? Why did we push Al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan into Pakistan, the only Islamic nation with nuclear weapons? Why did we fight a relatively meaningless megalomaniac in Iraq by forming alliances with the nations most responsible for manufacturing the actual terrorists who killed us? Who is responsible for this shameful state of affairs? We are. We get the government we deserve. Surrounded by information, we entertain ourselves with toys and sound bites. The answer to the most deadly question of our time isn't hidden. The evidence is all around us. During the promotional campaign for my first book on Islam, Tea with Terrorists, I sent every major media outlet and spokesperson a press kit. The opening paragraph asked the following questions. Don't you suppose that the Chechen Muslims who laid siege to the Moscow theater shared something with those who bombed the Bali nightclub and the Kenyan hotel? Don't you think there might be a connection between the sniper Muhammad and the prophet Muhammad? Could the suicide bombers in Israel have the same spiritual leader as the suicide bombers of 9/11? Why have Islamic terrorists in Iraq killed more Americans than the Republican Guard? Where do you suppose these Muslim militants get their marching orders? Might Al-Qaeda, Jamaat Islamiyah, Hamas, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, and the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Taliban be following the same prophet? Later that same week, Osama bin Laden issued a press release of his own. In it, he answered my questions. He said the boys who attacked the nightclub, theater, and hotel, as well as the suicide bombers in America and Israel, were, and quote, good Muslims, zealous Islamic fighters following Muhammad's example, unquote. Bin Laden was telling us who the terrorists really are and why they kill, yet we missed the message. Not a single media outlet tied these things together. Everyone went about their business, obfuscating reality. They called the Muslims who murdered us radicals, militants, insurgents, extremists, or simply terrorists. Why are we so afraid to speak the truth? Here's a clue. On top of one of my press releases, a South Palm Beach radio host wrote this note in her prettiest handwriting. Quote, I wouldn't promote your version of Islam even if I was an evangelical Christian on my deathbed. Unquote. Those who are paid to keep us informed have put their popularity and financial well-being ahead of saving lives. And while this is symptomatic of why we are ignorant, I don't have a, quote, version of Islam. The only Islam I know is the one found in the Quran, the one preached by the imams and sheikhs, the one promoted in the Islamic media, the one presented by the first Muslim scholars, Ibn Ishaq and Al-Tabari, the one recorded in the hadith collections of al-Bukhari and Muslim, the one Muhammad himself lived and taught, the one terrorists like Osama bin Laden practice. It isn't my version of Islam, it's theirs. How do you suppose Islam could be any different than the religions lived by its sole prophet, Muhammad? How could it differ from the doctrine espoused by its deity, Allah? If Islam's prophet and God got Islam wrong, who, pray tell, has it right? I have no interest in interpreting Islam. I simply want to expose it. I'm a reporter doing the job the media should have done, and I have a singular motivation. I want to save Muslims from Islam, and thereby save Christians and Jews from Muslims. Yes, I know, religions are supposed to be good. Most religious prophets are fine fellows, not terrorists, so all of this is a little hard to swallow. But one was a terrorist. Muhammad assassinated more journalists than any modern militant. He financed his religion entirely through piracy and the slave trade. This prophet was a genocidal maniac. Worse still, his God condoned terrorism, piracy, plunder, racism, genocide, deception, and assassination. Allah ordered his followers to kill us, and they did. The evidence screams out from the pages of the Quran, the hadith collections of Al-Tabari, Ibn Ishaq, Al-Bukhari, and Muslim. The case against Islam is a lay-down hand. The paper trail, their scripture, points directly to Islam's lone prophet. The blood evidence, both fresh and ancient, leads directly to Muhammad. We even have confessions, thousands of them. In the Quran, Allah commands Muslims to wipe the infidels out to the last. Allah isn't the least bit ambiguous. In the Hadith, Muslim says, "Kill any Jew who falls under your control. Kill them, for he who kills them will get a great reward." Today, terrorists are simply following their religion as it was originally conceived. Confronted with the evidence, one has to commit intellectual suicide to avoid seeing Islam as complicit in terror. The truth is obvious. The terrorists haven't corrupted their religion. Islam has corrupted them. The murderers are following their prophet's example. And while most Muslims aren't terrorists, the really good ones are. They haven't corrupted Islam any more than the SS corrupted Nazism or the kamikazes corrupted the culture of Imperial Japan. We have been fighting a war against the symptoms, not the source. The Nation of Islam has been at war with everyone, including itself, for 1,400 years. You'll see why Muslims celebrate their victories, no matter how many innocents perish. You'll see why their state-controlled media promotes terror. You'll know why their state-controlled schools teach hate. It will become evident why imams encourage martyrdom and jihad. And if all that were not bad enough, consider this. Our oil money pays for it all. The five oldest and most trusted Islamic sources don't portray Muhammad as a great and godly man. They reveal that he was a thief, a liar, an assassin, a pedophile, a womanizer, a rapist, a mass murderer, a pirate, a warmonger, and a scheming and ruthless politician. It's hardly the character profile of a religious leader. Gandhi, he was not. Islamic scholar D.S. Margalith sums up Muhammad in a paragraph that may seem shocking now, but once you've completed your journey through Islam's earliest scriptures, these words will appear tame. I quote, "The character attributed to Muhammad in the biography of Ibn Ishaq is exceedingly unfavorable. In order to gain his ends, Muhammad recoils from no expedient, and he approves of similar unscrupulousness on the part of his adherents when exercised in his interest. He organizes assassinations and wholesale massacres. His career as the tyrant of Medina is that of a robber chief whose political economy consists of securing and dividing plunder. He is himself an unbridled libertine, morally or sexually unrestrained, and encourages the same passion in his followers. For whatever he does, he is prepared to plead the express authorization of his deity. It is, however, impossible to find any Islamic religious doctrine which he is not prepared to abandon in order to secure a political end. At different points in his career, he abandons the unity of God and his claim to the title of prophet. This is a disagreeable picture for the founder of a religion, and it cannot be pleaded that it is the picture drawn by an enemy." Unquote. According to the Hadith in the Quran, Muhammad and his henchmen plundered their way to power and prosperity. Their bloody conquests rivaled those of the Assyrians, Genghis Khan, Attila the Hun, and more recently, Adolf Hitler. But Muhammad's murderous behavior didn't begin until he was halfway through his career. Therefore, I will address words and deeds that were simply foolish and immoral long before we arrive at those that were lethal. Yet it is not the immorality or foolishness of Islam that motivate me to share its story. It is Muhammad's legacy of terror. So as not to lose sight of that reality, I'd like to present a handful of stories that depict what Islam did to the first Muslims. Muhammad became so afraid of being exposed, he ordered his followers to assassinate anyone who criticized him. The first was a poet named Ashraf. In an illiterate society, poets were the journalists of their day. Their words swayed public opinion. Ashraf recognized that pirate and prophet were divergent career paths, and he had the courage to say so. This hadith is taken from Bukhari's collection, Volume 4, Book 52, Number 270.
Bukhari, "Allah's messenger said, 'Who is ready to kill Ashraf? He has said injurious things about Allah and his apostle.' Maslama got up saying, 'Would you like me to kill him?' The prophet proclaimed, "Yes." Maslama said, "Then allow me to lie, so that I will be able to deceive him." Muhammad said, "You may do so."
Islam gives Muslims a license to lie and kill. We pick up the story on page 94 of the History of al-Bukhari, volume 7.
Ashraf suspected no evil when Maslama cried, "Smite the enemy of Allah." So they smote him, and their swords clashed over him. Maslama said, "I remembered my dagger and seized it. I thrust it into the lower part of his body. I bore down on it until I reached his genitals. Allah's enemy fell to the ground."
Ishaq revealed this in the Sirah or biography of Muhammad.
Ishaq: "We carried his head back to Muhammad during the night, saluted the prophet as he stood praying, and cast Ashraf's head before his feet. The prophet praised Allah that the poet had been slain, and complimented us on the good work we had done in Allah's cause. Our attack on Allah's enemy cast terror among the Jews, and there was no Jew in Medina who did not fear for his life."
Murder and terror are Islam's good works.
Ishaq: "Ashraf's body was left prostrate. After his fall, all the Jews were brought low. Sword in hand, we cut him down. By Muhammad's order, we were sent secretly into his home by night. Brother killing brother, we lured him to his demise with deviousness. We made him taste death with our deadly swords. We sought victory for the religion of the Prophet." Then Tabari: "The morning after the murder of Ashraf, the Prophet declared, 'Kill any Jew who falls under your power.'" Ishaq: "Thereupon Masud leapt upon Sun Aya, one of the Jewish merchants with whom his family had social and commercial relations, and killed him. The Muslim's brothers complained, saying, 'Why did you kill him? You have much fat in your belly from his charity.' Masud answered, 'By Allah, had Muhammad ordered me to murder you, my brother, I would have cut off your head.' Wherein the brother said, 'Any religion that can bring you to this is indeed wonderful.'"
This man was crediting the religion of Islam for transforming his brother into an unthinking killing machine. The motivation was purely racist.
From Bukhari: "Just issue orders to kill every Jew in the country."
Innocent blood still dripping from his hands, Masud proclaimed for all the world to hear, "Muhammad ordered me to murder." Today's terrorists haven't corrupted their religion. Their religion has corrupted them. While hideous, this act does not stand alone. Soon thereafter, Muhammad ordered Muslims to assassinate Salam. Tabari, Islam's earliest historian, explains.
Tabari: "They asked the Prophet for permission to kill Salam. He granted it. When they got to Kabar, they went to Salam's house by night, having locked every door in the settlement on the inhabitants. He was in an upper chamber. His wife came out and asked who we were. We told her that we were Arabs in search of supplies. She told us that her husband was in bed. We entered and bolted his door. His wife shrieked and warned him of us, so we ran at him with our swords as he lay on his bed. When we had smitten him, Abdallah bore down his sword into his belly until it went right through him. By the God of the Jews, he is dead. Never have I heard sweeter words than those. We returned to Allah's apostle and told him that we had killed his enemy. We disputed before him as to who had killed him, each of us laying claim to the deed. Muhammad demanded to see our swords, and when he looked at them, he said, 'It is the sword of Abdallah that killed him. I can see traces of food on it.'"
Deceiving victims is standard operating procedure for Muslim militants. Attacking defenseless civilians is the very definition of terror, and so is gloating. Today's Islamic terrorists are as eager as Muhammad's original henchmen to claim credit for their deeds. Ishaq Sirah recounts a third Muhammad-inspired execution.
Ishaq: Halfway to Medina, Akba was called out to be executed.
Since the other prisoners were being held for ransom, Akba asked Muhammad why he was being treated more harshly than the other captives.
The Prophet said, "Because of your enmity to Allah and His Prophet." "And my little girl," cried Akba in bitterness, "who will take care of her?" "Hellfire," Muhammad responded. At that moment he was decapitated. "Wretch that you were," Muhammad eulogized. "You scoffed at me and claimed that your stories were better than mine. I gave thanks that Allah has slain you and comforted me."
Allah condoned the murder in the 8th surah of the Quran, the 68th verse.
Quran 8:68. "It has not been for any prophet to take captives until he has slaughtered in the land."
Allah approved kidnapping for ransom so long as his prophet slaughtered first. Akba said something Muslims didn't like, so they murdered him. No wonder authors, journalists, and politicians are afraid to critique Islam. Looking to rob a Jewish community for a second time, Muhammad had one of his militants torture an innocent man. The tale is recounted by Ishaq and Tabari.
Tabari and Ishaq. The Prophet gave orders concerning Kenaya to Zub'ayyar, saying, "Torture him until you root out and extract what he has." So Zub'ayyar kindled a fire on Kenaya's chest, swirling it with his fire stick until Kenaya was near death. Then the messenger gave him to Maslama, who beheaded him, then to Bakati. The Prophet said, "The hellfire is 69 times hotter than ordinary worldly fires." So someone said, "Allah's apostle, wouldn't this ordinary fire have been sufficient to torture the non-Muslims?"
You will soon discover that the Nazi Führer and the Islamic Prophet had more in common than just using fire to eradicate Jews. Beginning in the Mein Kampf chapter, I will compare Hitler's manifesto with Muhammad's so that you might know how stunningly similar they are. By so doing, you'll come to appreciate the consequence of tolerating Islam. Let's take one more example. Ishaq's Sirah speaks of the murder of another journalist, Asma bint Warwan. She spoke critically of Muhammad, telling her tribe to be wary of him.
Ishaq, "You obey a stranger who encourages you to murder for booty. You are greedy men. Is there no honor among you?" Upon hearing those lines, Muhammad said, "Will no one rid me of this woman?" Umar, a zealous Muslim, decided to execute the Prophet's wishes. That very night, he crept into the writer's home while she lay sleeping, surrounded by her young children. There was one at her breast. Umar removed the suckling babe, and then he plunged his sword into the poet. The next morning in the mosque, Muhammad, who was aware of the assassination, said, "You have helped Allah and His apostle." Umar said, "She had 5 sons. Should I feel guilty?" "No," the Prophet answered. "Killing her was as meaningless as 2 goats butting heads."
These events are but a handful among hundreds of horrific tales of barbarism described in the Islamic Hadith. Many are far worse and include the enslavement of children, rape, and mass murder. What you are going to read from Islam's most holy books will begin as laughable. The creation accounts are dim-witted to the point of being delirious. The religion's desperate grope to convolute the lives and times of biblical patriarchs to establish a sense of legitimacy for its scriptures, shrine, rituals, God, and prophet is pathetic. As the chronology marches on, you'll meet Qusay, Muhammad's great-great-great-grandfather, and discover how he invented the 5 pillars of Islam as a mystic scam. The story gets particularly interesting at this point as we uncover what Islam has to say about its prophet's abused childhood. As a result, Islam, by its own admission, becomes a money-making scheme. Everything is driven by an unquenchable thirst for revenge and a man-sized lust for power, control, sex, money, and praise. And that's not my opinion or even an interpretation. It's what the Islamic scriptures say. Then the religion becomes very dark. Muhammad's first Quranic revelations are demonic, fixated on disgusting depictions of hell. Devils called jinn, pain and punishment. And that's the good part. The moment Muhammad and his gang slither out of Mecca, they pick up the sword and never put it down. What you are going to read from the Islamic scriptures will shake you to your core. You will be revolted and terrified, especially if you're a Muslim. And that is the purpose of Prophet of Doom. I want the world to know Muhammad, Allah, and Islam as they are presented in their scriptures. But that's easier said than done. While the average terrorist knows the Quran and the Hadith nearly as well as I do, the vast majority of Muslims do not. Peaceful Muslims have been fed a fictitious picture of their prophet and God, one that's wholly inconsistent with their own scriptures. Clerics have lied to them, just as they have lied to us. Yet, as I discovered in my meetings with them, the jihadists have memorized the verses you are going to read. So if we want to know why they kill and how to stop them, we must come to understand them too. Otherwise, we're flailing at the wind, spilling blood and coin while they grow more resolute. The Quran may be the worst book ever written. It is jumbled together haphazardly. It is almost as if verses were tossed into the air, blown by the wind, and then pieced together as they were plucked from the sand. The first surah, or chapter, was never revealed, and it's written in the wrong voice. The second surah was the 91st received chronologically, yet it's the first revelation in the Quran. The fifth surah was the last in order of the alleged revelation. Muhammad claims that his initial inspiration can be found in the 96th surah, which means Allah's initial salvo is tucked in the back of the book. Unrelated subjects are brought together without intelligent transitions. Allah's book lacks context as well. It does not explain who is talking to whom or even where its narratives took place. But that's not the worst of it. The Quran is so poorly written that 1 in 5 verses makes no sense at all in any language. This is why Muslims don't want it translated out of religious Arabic, a language few understand. And that's not the end of the bad news. Much of the Quran is plagiarized from uninspired Jewish writings, most often from the Talmud. Allah's book is repetitive to a fault. The same stories are retold, sometimes dozens of times. There are countless contradictions and a plethora of scientific and historical errors. What's more, the Quran's message is immoral. Allah approves incest, rape, lying, thievery, deception, slavery, torture, mass murder, and even terrorism. The Quran begins as a mean-spirited rant. The eyewitness, the men and women who knew Muhammad and Islam far better than anyone today, said things like,
Quran 38:3. The disbelievers say this, Prophet Muhammad, is a sorcerer, a charlatan, a wizard telling lies. He has made the al-iha, gods, into one ilah, God. This is a curious and strange thing, to be sure. Their leader said, walk away from him. There is surely some motive behind this, something sought after, a thing he has designed against us. It is surely a forgery.
Allah responded by threatening.
Quran 38:8. Nay, but they are in doubt about my reminder, this Quran. Nay, but they have not tasted my torment yet. They will be one more army vanquished among the many routed hordes. They rejected my messenger, so my torment is justified.
The same rant is played out nearly 400 times.
Quran 74:21. Again, woe to them! May they be cursed for how they plotted. They looked about, frowned, and scowled with pleasure. They turned back and were haughty with pride. They said, this is nothing but magical enchantment, derived and narrated from others. This is nothing but the words of a mortal man.
The Quran's most repetitive theme, one detailed no less than 1,000 times, is a derivative of this rejection. Allah threatens all who deny Muhammad and Islam.
Quran 85:10. Those who try to tempt the believers will have the penalty of hell. They will have the doom of the burning fire. Verily, the seizure of the Lord is severe and painful. Allah will encompass them from behind. He will punish them. Nay, this is a glorious Quran. Quran 13:32. Many an apostle have they mocked before you, but I seize them. How awful was my punishment then. The unbelievers plot, but for them is the torment in this life and far more severe torture in hell. Quran 2:23. If you are in doubt about what we have revealed to our messenger, then bring a surah like this, and call any witness apart from Allah. But you cannot, as indeed you cannot guard yourself against the hellfires, whose fuel is men's bodies and rocks, which have been prepared for the infidels.
If the endless rant and demented threats were all there were to the Quran, you could safely put down this book and ignore Allah's foolishness, but I'm afraid I have some very bad news. The Quran's last 24 surahs, chronologically, those revealed in Medina, are a call to arms. They are merciless. In them, Allah says things like...
Quran 9:88. The messenger and those who believe with him strive hard and fight with their wealth and lives in Allah's cause. Quran 9:5. Fight and kill the disbelievers wherever you find them. Take them captive. Torture them. Lie in wait and ambush them using every stratagem of war. Quran 9:112. Believers fight in Allah's cause. They slay and are slain. Kill and are killed. Quran 9:29. Fight those who do not believe until they all surrender, paying the protective tax in submission.
As horrible as that sounds, it gets worse. Allah claims personal responsibility for terrorism, mass murder, enslaving women and children, deception, and thievery. Arguably, Islam's most revealing book is the Sirah, not the Quran. The Sirah provides the lone account of Muhammad's life and the formation of Islam written within 2 centuries of the Prophet's death. It provides the context and chronology the Quran requires. Unfortunately, there is no surviving copy of Ishaq's manuscript called Sirat Rasul Allah. Therefore, Muslims are dependent upon a significantly edited and abridged account by Hisham. His sanitized version of Muhammad's words, dogma, and deeds was translated by Guillaume under the title The Life of Muhammad in 1955 and published by the Oxford Press. Ishaq's biography paints an unflattering portrait of Islam's unique prophet. I include thousands of Sirah quotations in Prophet of Doom. Each references Ishaq's name as well as the page number in the specific hadith, as recorded in Guillaume's English translation of Hisham's edits of Ishaq's Sirah. The history of al-Tabari is by common consent the most important and earliest universal history produced in the world of Islam. It is written conversationally by piecing together Islamic hadith, or oral reports, from the men and women who lived with Muhammad and became his companions. While each tradition comes complete with a chain of transmitters called an isnad, I have omitted the long list of Arabic names as they serve no purpose. Islamic scholars believe that these hadith reveal inspired behavior that should be emulated. They claim that the revelations themselves were inspired by Allah and thus are scripture. Collectively, the chronological hadith collections brought to us by Ishaq and Tabari form the Sunnah. The Sunnah provides the basis of Islamic rituals, behaviors, laws, and conquests. Although the entire al-Tabari series of 38 volumes was translated and published by the State University of New York Press, you will find volumes 1, 2, 6, 7, 8, and 9 to be the most revealing. They deal with Islamic creation, the Jewish patriarchs, Mecca before and during Muhammad's day, and the rise of Islam in Medina. my review of Islam ends with Muhammad's death, and thus the remaining volumes, which chronicle the Islamic conquests of Arabia, the Middle East, Africa, Europe, Asia, all fall outside the scope of this volume. Al-Bukhari's hadith is second only to the Quran in importance to many Muslims. It is comprised of what scholars consider to be the most authentic traditions associated with early Islam and the words of Muhammad. Its hadith are organized by subject. The Book of Taxes, the Book of Raids, and the Book of Jihad are examples. An online Bukhari translation by Mushin Khan opens with these words.
Sayyid Bukhari is a collection of sayings and deeds of Prophet Muhammad, also known as the Sunnah. The reports of the Prophet's saying and deeds are called hadith. Bukhari lived a couple of centuries after the Prophet's death and worked to collect his hadith. Each report in his collection was checked for compatibility with the Quran, and the veracity of the chain of reporters, or isnad, had to be painstakingly established. Bukhari's collection is recognized by the overwhelming majority of Muslims as one of the most authentic collections of Muhammad's Sunnah.
Finally, there is Muslim's collection. His work is complementary to Bukhari, for he was one of his students. Together, these four books give the Quran the context it otherwise lacks, and they give Muslims the religious rites, rituals, and rules they would otherwise do without. In fact, Islam's five pillars would not exist without the hadith, and the Quran would be indecipherable. Speaking of the Quran, I encourage you to buy several, because translations differ. I have elected to combine five into a blended version for the purpose of communicating the nuances of an ancient and little understood language into contemporary English. These include Ahmed Ali, Pickthall, Noble by Khan, Yusuf Ali, and Shakir. I have corrected Allah's grammar, pruned his unruly repetitions, and tried to identify many of his dangling modifiers. There are so many missing and meaningless words, I have left the additions Arabic translators made, because without them, Allah's message is hopelessly muddled. Fortunately, by ordering the Quran chronologically and by setting it in the context of the Islamic Sunnah, I believe its message has never been as clear as it is in these pages. Trying to hide the Quran's hostile and vile message, Muslim clerics claim that it cannot be translated. But that's nonsense. They simply don't want anyone to know what Allah's book actually says. They know it's unworthy, hateful, violent, and intolerant. The Quran is very nasty. It's dim-witted, demonic, and deceitful. It promotes immorality and inspires terror. That's not to say the Quran is completely void of rational thought. About 5% of it, taken out of context and mistranslated, can be misconstrued as peaceful and tolerant. For example, Quran 5:32 says,
"On that account, we ordained for the children of Israel that if anyone slew a person, unless it be in retaliation for murder or for spreading mischief in the land, it would be as if he slew all mankind. And if anyone saved a life, it would be as if he saved the life of all humanity."
That sounds good until you realize that the line was plagiarized verbatim from the Mishnah Sanhedrin, and that it was followed by Quran 5:33.
"The punishment for those who wage war against Allah and His Messenger and who do mischief, which is non-Islamic behavior, in the land, is only that they shall be killed or crucified, or their hands and feet shall be cut off on opposite sides, or they shall be exiled. That is their disgrace in this world, and a dreadful torment is theirs in hell."
Muslim apologists say that the Quran is tolerant because it says,
Quran 5:69, "Those who believe in the Quran, those who follow the Jewish scriptures, and Christians, whoever believes in God and the last day and does right, on them shall be no fear, nor shall they grieve."
But this verse correctly translated says,
"Whoever believes in Allah shall not fear and grieve."
Further, it must be plucked from its context, as the surrounding verses proclaim,
Quran 5:13, "But because of their breach of the covenant, we cursed the Jews and made their hearts grow hard. They change words from their right places, the illiterate prophet pronounced, and forgot a good part of the message that was sent to them. Nor will you cease to find deceit in them. 5:14. For those, too, who call themselves Christians, we made a covenant, but they forgot a good part of the message that was sent to them, so we estranged them, stirred up enmity and hatred among them. 5:17. Say, who has the least power against Allah if he were to destroy Christ, the Messiah, and everyone else on earth? 5:37. The Christian disbelievers will long to get out of the fire, but never will they get out. Theirs will be an unending torture.
This next verse also sounds tolerant, at least until you read what follows.
Quran 5:46. And in their footsteps we sent Jesus, son of Mary, confirming the law that had come before him. We sent him the gospel. Therein was guidance and light, and confirmation of the law that had come before him. Quran 5:49. Judge between them by what Allah has revealed, and follow not their Christian desires, but beware of them, lest they beguile you, seducing you away from any of that which Allah has sent down to you. And if they turn you away from Islam, be assured that for their crime it is Allah's purpose to smite them. Quran 5:51. Believers, take not Jews and Christians as friends. 5:59. Say, people of the book, do you disapprove of us because we believe in Allah and in the revelation that has come to us? Say, shall I point out to you something which is worse than this by the treatment it received from Allah? Those who incurred the curse of Allah and his wrath, those Jews he transformed into apes and swine. 5:72. They are surely infidels who blaspheme and say, God is Christ, the Messiah. But the Messiah only said, children of Israel, worship Allah. Lo, whoever joins other gods with Allah or says he has a partner, Allah has forbidden paradise, and hell will be his abode. 5:73. They are surely disbelievers who blaspheme and say, God is one of three in the Trinity, for there is no Ilah, God, except one, Allah. If they desist not from saying this, verily a grievous penalty will befall them.
Allah's only interest in Christians and Jews is tormenting them in hell.
Quran 98:1. Those among the people of the book who disbelieve would never have been freed from their false religion if the clear proofs had not come to them. An apostle of Allah came reading out of hallowed pages containing firm decrees. They were commanded to serve Allah exclusively, fulfilling their devotional obligations and paying the zakat tax. Surely the unbelievers from the people of the book will abide in the hellfire. They are the worst of creatures.
The Quran's message is intolerant, hateful, and violent. There is another reason Muslim clerics and kings don't want the Quran translated. By doing so, their biggest deception dissolves. Muslims protest that Allah is simply the Arabic word for God and that we all worship the same spirit. But that's simply not true. The Quran says that Ilah is the Arabic word for God and that Allah is his name.
Quran 3:62. This is the true explanation. There is no Ilah, God, except Allah. Quran 52:43. Have they an Ilah, God, other than Allah? Quran 5:4. Pronounce the name of Allah and fear Allah. Quran 21:107. Say, it is revealed to me that your Ilah, God, is only one Ilah, God. Quran 28. Allah. There is no Ilah, God, save him. Quran 20:14. Verily, I am Allah. No Ilah, God, may be worshipped but I. Quran 20:97. Your Ilah, God, is Allah. There is no Ilah, God, but he. Quran 59:22. Allah is he. No other Ilah, God, may be worshipped. He is Allah, whom there is no other Ilah, God.
This is important because the Judeo-Christian God, the God of the Bible, has a name, Yahweh. Not only isn't Allah Yahweh, his character could not be more opposed. Allah is a very nasty and deceptive fellow.
Quran 4:142. Surely the hypocrites strive to deceive Allah. He shall retaliate by deceiving them. Quran 68:44. Then leave me alone with such as reject this message and call our pronouncements a lie. Systematically, by degree, step by step, we shall punish them in ways they cannot even imagine. Quran 89:23. For his, says Allah's, chastisement will be such as no other can inflict. None punishes as he will punish. None can bind as he will bind. Quran 64:11. No calamity occurs, no affliction comes, except by the decision and preordainment of Allah. Quran 96:15. Let him beware. If he does not desist, we will seize him, smite his forehead, and drag him by the forelock. Then we will call upon our angels of punishment to deal with him. Quran 74:15. They have offered stubborn opposition to our signs. Soon I will visit them with a mountain of calamities, imposing a distressful punishment. For men thought and plotted, woe to them! They shall be cursed. Quran 74:26. Soon I will fling them into the burning hellfire. It permits nothing to endure, and nothing does it spare. It darkens the color of man, burning the skin. It shrivels and scorches men. Quran 88:1. Some faces, in parentheses, all disbelievers, Jews and Christians, into parentheses, will be humiliated and scorched by the burning fire, while they are made to drink boiling water. Quran 18:108. Verily, we have prepared hell for the hospitality of the infidels. Hell is for the disbelievers' punishment.
No, we do not worship the same God, nor follow the same prophet. To better understand the nature of Islam's dark spirit, to grasp his twisted, mean, and violent message, I encourage you to browse the Muhammad's Own Words appendix as time permits. You may want to begin with what the eyewitnesses had to say, as their testimony was remarkably accurate. Their view of Muhammad, Allah, and Islam is identical to my own. If you think Islam is peaceful, read quotes from the fighting, terror, war, jihad, martyrs, and militants sections first. If you think Islam is religious, start with the thievery, murder, torture, deception, megalomania, money, and lust categories. If you think Islam is tolerant, you should scan quotations under intolerance, Jews, Christians, women, and racism. If you think we all worship the same God, read demons, Allah, Ar-Rahman, hell, paradise, no choice, stupidity, Islamic science, and Allah's astronomy. If you have the time and fortitude, dive into the world of Islamic scholarship. The best research was conducted by Arthur Jeffrey, D.S. Margolith, Sir W. Muir, Patricia Crone and F.E. Peters, Ernest Renan, Joseph Schacht, and John Waynesborough. For a little lighter reading, try Sir John Glubb's The Life and Times of Muhammad or Mark Gabriel's Islam and Terrorism. If you haven't done so already, familiarize yourself with the Judeo-Christian scriptures, because Islam is based upon twisted Bible stories. At the very least, read Genesis and Matthew, so you're in a position to judge whether the original or the Islamicized versions are more credible. And while the Bible is unfazed by Islam, for the Quran to be true, the Torah must be both inspired by God and be wrong on every page. Also, consider reading at least one book on Bible archaeology. Understanding the Bible's historic roots is essential if you wish to render an informed decision about the Quran's variant claims. Recognizing that most people don't have the will, time, or means to invest 10,000 hours into the study of Islam, I have done the heavy lifting for you. I have distilled Islam's 5 earliest books into one, and rather than taking them out of context, I have organized them chronologically and woven them together. You will see Muhammad, Allah, and Islam as they really are. So that you might appreciate the consequence of ignoring Islam, I have included sections comparing the Islamic scriptures to Hitler's Mein Kampf. Formed as a religion to inspire martyrdom, Nazism caused the worst war in human history. Yet apart from time and place, Islam and Nazism are indistinguishable. As you read Prophet of Doom, you will begin to question the validity of Islamic sources. The Hadith and Quran are so errant historically, logically, and scientifically, you'll think that I'm quoting from sources hostile to Islam rather than from their most revered scriptures. When you come to that point, I encourage you to visit the Source Material Appendix. It's a scholarly review of the works that comprise Islam, their inspiration, history, and authority. This analysis will be particularly helpful for Muslims, since their imams have lied to them about the nature of their scriptures. Most rational men and women will conclude that a God who is principally vengeful, forgetful, contradictory, and irrational might not be a God after all. But why should we care? It's a free world, and Muslims are entitled to their beliefs. What's more, Christians have at times behaved no better. Who are we to cast stones? The fact is, Muslims are killing us and will continue to kill us until we have the good sense to understand the doctrine that drives them to such behavior. Besides, the Muslim world isn't free. It has never been free. Okay, so Muslims aren't free. So what? Why are their problems our problems? Because we are free. We have the opportunity and responsibility to diagnose this disease before it consumes our life, liberty, and prosperity as it has theirs. So fasten your seatbelts. It's time to expose Islam.
Here are some concluding quotes. Bukhari. Muhammad said, "A single endeavor of fighting in Allah's cause is better than the world and whatever is in it."
Fighting is not only considered good, it is Islam's best deed.
Bukhari. Allah's apostle said, "I have been made victorious with terror. The treasures of the world were brought to me and put in my hand." Bukhari. Allah's apostle said, "I have been made victorious with terror. The treasures of the world were brought to me and put in my hand."
Terror is Muhammad's legacy. His motivation was money.
Bukhari. I heard the Prophet saying, "Islam cannot change."
It can't be reformed. Islam remains mired in deceit, hate, and violence.
Bukhari. The Prophet said, "If a Muslim discards his religion, kill him."
This is why we must free Muslims from Islam. Without our help, death is their only way out.
Bukhari. The Prophet said, "If I take an oath and later find something else better than that, then I do what is better and expiate my oath."
Translated into common English, he just said, "I am a lying scumbag. You should not trust me."